Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This episode of Groundwire is produced on Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe Traditional Territory in Kingston by CFRC. I am your host, Nathan Bateman. On this episode, we'll be discussing the Women's Summit in Montreal and various other issues that pertain to International Women's Day.
Went over there, volunteered, and realized how amazing and empowering the camp can be to youth and young girls and young women, and started it over here.
My both parents were murdered while I was in residential school. My two grandfathers were murdered, still no justice. And I have a niece, Tanya Nipinak, still missing.
This proceedings, because this is new for me, that they handpicked the six of us. They purposely stacked who they wanted in court.
But first, here are the headlines. On February 22nd, hundreds of students at McGill University voted in a General Assembly to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. The students called on their society to join the global movement for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. The motion also directed the Board of Governors, the highest governing body of McGill, to divest from three companies that are directly profiting from illegal occupation of Palestinian territory. The student vote at McGill took place on the same day the Canadian government passed a motion condemning the Boycotts, Divestment, and Sanctions, or BDS, movement against Israel. The successful student vote at McGill was later defeated in a 72-hour online ratification process that may be subject to appeal due to infractions. In the hours following the release of the online ratification results, McGill's principal issued a statement. The email signed by Principal Susan Fortier explained why the university's administration continues to steadfastly oppose the BDS movement. Students, alumni, and faculty supporting BDS at McGill organized statements condemning the principal's message. Lucas, a student member of BDS McGill, spoke with CKUT about the principal's email.
Like you mentioned, we were extremely disappointed by that email. I think it was a very rash undertaking. It was sent out 30 minutes after the results of the vote, and really it condemned to more than 2,000 students that had really listened into the debate and voted in favor of BDS. The tone of the letter was disrespectful. It was condescending and very silencing, which is quite ironic because Suzanne Fortier in that email talks about equity and exchange of views, but by her silencing of our entire group, she's really breaking the discussion, and she's clearly not ready to be open to a discussion on this. A lot of students and Palestinian students are already alienated on campus, and McGill has just grounded its implicit stance on this contentious issue by sending out such a letter.
Students from Palestine issued their own letters of support for the motion passed by McGill University students. They wrote,
"Supporting the Palestinian-led global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is one of the most important steps that student unions internationally can take to stand in solidarity with our struggle for freedom, justice, and equality."
The letter can be found online at www.pacbi.org, the website of the Palestinian Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel. That's www.pacbi.org. For more information about the campaign for BDS at McGill University, visit www.mcgillbds.com. This headline was produced by CKUT Radio in Montreal, with audio clips provided by Susan. This is a piece by myself in regards to the recent layoffs for Ontario nurses. Earlier this month, CBC reported NDP leader Andrea Horwath blamed funding shortages in healthcare as forcing nurses to do work beyond the scope of their training. Cuts in the healthcare system continue across Ontario. Just last month, over 400 registered nurses have been let go across the province. That is more than half of all the registered nurses laid off in 2015. There has been public backlash, particularly from nursing unions. Some groups have suggested overworking undertrained staff and firing hundreds of workers is an unacceptable way to pay back provincial debt, and it's time for Ontario hospitals to respect their workers as they should. That's it for the headlines. We'll be right back after this. You are now listening to Groundwire. It's time for our feature story.
Next up is Audrey Obreham from Groundwire, who interviewed Mary Josie Parent about the 2016 Women's Summit in Montreal. Parent is the manager of Destination, as well as one of the signatories of the Women's Summit Manifesto.
Marie-Josée Parent, je suis directrice
manager of Destination and Indigenous Cultural Embassy Project in Montreal. I am also co-organizer of the Women's Summit that occurred March 3rd and 4th, 2016 in Montreal, as well as co-writer of the Women's Manifest launched in November 2015. I am a Mi'kmaq and Acadian and a feminist. I have decided to get involved in the Women's Summit and the writing of the manifest, as I think it is an aberration to still have to fight for gender equality in today's world. It is a citizen summit that seeks to provide a space for discussion to all citizens. The goal is to include Indigenous women, to give ourselves a space in the society at large, to create a space where role models can have a voice so that our young people get involved and are able to understand that they can also build the world to their image and liking. Our Indigenous women are involved in discussion panels such as young women and activism, violence towards women. They are our conference speakers, our organizers. They are experts in the same way as all of the other women. We sought them out because of their expertise, their understanding of the world, their worldview, rather than solely because they are Indigenous.
You are listening to Groundwire. Michael Welch from CKUW brings us coverage from the February 14, 2016 search for missing and murdered Indigenous women in Winnipeg. He also updates us on the 3-day consultation with the families of missing and murdered Indigenous women that occurred in Winnipeg on February 24th to 26th, 2016.
February 14th marked the 9th annual Women's Memorial March in Winnipeg. Over 100 people made it out to the Winnipeg event. Some of those voices let us know what the gathering meant to them.
Something needs to be done, and it needs to be in a respectful way.
My friend Jennifer Catchaway has been missing since June 2008. That's why I come out all the time.
We're all doing this together as cousins in our community. So we're here to support women and children. We're here to support all vulnerable people.
My both parents were murdered while I was in residential school. My two grandfathers were murdered, still no justice. And I have a niece, Tanya Nipinak, still missing. Every event that's happening, I join.
Nahani Fontaine, Special Advisor on Aboriginal Women's Issues for the Government of Manitoba. Probably in 1999, there was a mom who was shot and killed, and her little son was shot as well. And I remember at that time, the individual that did it was completely exonerated. For me, that completely enraged me. For that to happen in Canada, it just was something that I felt I had to stand against. And so literally, I remember that was one of those first moments that that was the beginning for me on this journey.
The federal Liberals have promised an inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls and have consulted families of the missing and murdered. Bernadette Smith is the sister of Claudette Osborne, who went missing in 2008. She attended these consultations, including the National Roundtable, which took place in Winnipeg, February 24th, 26th.
You know, our ministers and our premiers went back to their provinces with, you know, hopefully some tangible things that they can do. And we really gave credit, a lot of credit, to Premier Wynne in Ontario for announcing $100 million to, you know, address the violence against women. So we're really looking for those kinds of things to be happening in other provinces as well. And, you know, they have a plan that they're rolling out with some tangible things that are going to address that. So, you know, enough of the talk. Now it's time for the action.
In recent days, a 14-year-old teenager named Brianna Johnny made headlines after writing an open letter to the chief of the Winnipeg Police Service arguing that authorities treat missing person cases differently when the person reported is Indigenous. She mentioned that public searches for non-Indigenous Winnipeggers like Cooper Nemeth began within a day of him going missing, while the search for 15-year-old Tina Fontaine was not publicized until 4 days after her disappearance.
You know, I think about the response from, you know, the father of Cooper Nemeth's dad, right? And him saying that, you know, it takes family and community and assembling those people, right? When my sister went missing, like, our family assembled and we did what we could. But ultimately, you know, we felt that our race had a lot to do with it, because some people didn't come out because, you know, we're Indigenous and, you know, just another, you know, girl gone missing, you know, desensitized, not my problem, it's over there. And I think, you know, some people are privileged in the very color of their skin, and they've never had to feel that. So, you know, I think of those stories, and how do we help people understand the privilege that they're coming from, and how to deconstruct that and make it into a constructive kind of, you know, part of Canada and helping one another.
From Winnipeg on Treaty 1 territory, on the homeland of the Métis Nation, this is CKUW's Michael Welch for Groundwire.
Up next, we hear from Yvonne Tupper, member of Treaty 8, with her response to Supreme Court injunction order on Protectors of the Land versus BC Hydro CITEC Dam in British Columbia.
And with the terms of, we have less than 12 hours to vacate. I'm in Vancouver right now. It's a 14-hour drive for me to drive back to the camp, and so I got to make this press conference short because I need to be with my campers back up north. Is there any questions? I plan to respect the injunction, yes. Well, I kind of knew that when I learned that BC had, during this proceedings, because this is new for me, that they handpicked the six of us. They purposely stacked who they wanted in court, not the other 25 plus people that were in camp in January 2016 or the others that came afterwards in February. And also to the other respective members that are concerned about our valley that was there. So they hand-selected who they wanted in the courtroom and be named.
And why do you think they did that and chose the people they did?
As you heard this today in court, that with the other four court cases, they were successful, and two of them to defeat them in court. So two are on appeal, and we're still waiting for justice review for our treaty rights and other matters. And also, too, there's upcoming court cases that was applied opposing Site C.
What sort of emotion are you feeling?
Well, you know, I kind of expected this as, sorry, you weren't here earlier, when I said our treaty rights is a promise with the federal government. It's upheld and honored by the federal government, not with the BC Supreme Court, obviously, and not with the provincial court. This, what it does inspire me to say is that BC Hydro and the BC government need to start looking at culture competencies and start learning about Indigenous peoples and treaty rights. We're a named number treaty in the northeast of BC, which is unique than other Aboriginal titles of BC. We have a large area mass of Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Northwest Territories. And to learn about us through this process, we have 40 years of saying no from other political First Nations throughout the years. This is nothing new for us, but here to have Supreme Court ruling, we're not here to not obey it. We're here to obey it. But we also, I knew that this is not the forum for it.
Well, the judge talked a lot about what's in the public interest. Talk about what you felt when you heard him say that.
Well, I'm quite the complex human being. I felt a lot of range of emotions. But also, too, is like, to know that the defense, our affidavits for defense, our expert witnesses, actually proved that if the cost delay for the Site C dam for 2 years is $518 million, you know, we'd be saving BCians as a whole money if this dam is not constructed. And the recent dates of Jessica McDonough announcing the 4% increase rate And one of them probably would be Bede, because LNG and other components to the Site C dam backed away. And so this dam is not needed. It's not so green dam with lifelong massive destruction. And to me, that, you know, we wouldn't be here if it wasn't done properly, put it that way. If the consultation that they spoke about was done properly with listening and hearing and changing, instead of saying, oh, look, we're here and we're going to do it. Now you're chose. You have to say yes.
Friend Chief Stuart Phillip, President of the Union of BC Union Chiefs. I just want to begin by saying the UBCIC still stands in solidarity with Treaty 8 stewards of the land. And I want to make it very clear here today that this fight is by no means over. This was a minor skirmish in the BC Supreme Court. It certainly is not the final chapter in this sordid narrative of the Site C dam that seems like it'll never die. This zombie tale of the Site C dam. The judge himself admitted that this is an enormous issue and that there are a multitude of very, very serious and important issues in play here, and the courtroom is not the venue to sort out those issues. So again, this is just another day at the office, another battle in this decades-old fight. The provincial government, through BC Hydro, keeps changing their story about why this dam is necessary. It was bitterly disappointing to hear a status quo judgment in a world that has changed dramatically with respect to Indigenous land rights. Obviously, the courts have not caught up, and you know, tomorrow's another day to continue this fight. I'm incredibly proud and honored to stand in solidarity with Treaty 8 stewards of the land, many of them which are young women who are standing on their treaty rights. And at the end of the day, the treaty rights will prevail.
This audio was brought to us by Gennargi O'Sullivan from CFRO. CJSF brings us an interview about Girls Rock Camp.
Next up, we have an interview with Louie from Girl Rock Camp. Girls Rock Camp is a summer camp for girls focused on learning instruments and the joy of playing music. Campers participate in instrument instructions, workshops, and band practice where they collaborate with their band and write an original song. No musical experience is necessary. Girls Rock Camp is inspired by the needs to promote change in the music industry and young women's lives.
So we have Louie on the phone.
Hi.
Hi, Louie. This is Natalie. Thank you so much for joining us today. We'd like to ask you first, where did the idea for this camp originate from?
Well, it's a whole string of camps happening internationally. And so Vancouver's Girls Rock Camp, I do not believe, was the originator of the camp.
Okay.
Definitely a group of people about 7 years ago heard about camp and recognized the power it had, and I believe that some of those organizers had attended and volunteered at the Portland Girls Rock Camp. So they went over there, volunteered, and realized how amazing and empowering the camp can be to youth and young girls and young women, and started it over here.
Well, that's great. And how do you feel that this camp has evolved over the years?
I think it just keeps growing. More and more people want to participate. Lots of volunteers want to be part of it. And there's so many campers that want to be going to this camp every year. And unfortunately, there's a huge wait list for it. So not as many youth and girls get to participate in the camp as we wish we could, but we're trying to work on that and get more funding so we can put more than one camp on every year.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. And where is the camp run currently, or this summer, where will it be running?
Yeah, it's happening and it's hosted at UNYA, the Urban Native Youth Association, and they have been very generous with their space, and they give us their space free of charge every summer for 1 week.
Oh, that's wonderful. So it's only 1 week.
Yeah, it's 1 week of camp.
Also, you can understand why there would be a wait list for it.
Exactly.
And so how many volunteers are working on this project?
During camp, there's probably about 30 to 40 volunteers, and then there's 30 campers. So there's almost more volunteer adults to the camp than there are campers themselves.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah.
So what kind of instruments are taught?
There is keyboards, so electric keyboards, drums, guitar, bass, and vocals. Those are kind of our main spots.
And has registration already started for the summer?
We have just received the camp dates. Camp will be from July 25th to July 29th. And we are sending out registration very soon. So probably this coming week.
And how?
Possibly in the next 2 weeks, yeah.
Okay, great. And do you have a link for us, a website where people can go to if they're interested? Because it sounds like such a great initiative. I know that actually one of Ayana's friends was in camp last year.
Oh, no way. That's so great.
Yeah.
So good to hear.
Yeah, it was really
If you go to girlsrockcampvancouver.ca, that is our website, and you can find all the information on there how to register.
You are listening to Groundwire. Now it's time for our community radio report. For this edition, we bring you coverage of International Women's Day by AMARC.
We start by speaking to Andrea O'Reilly, a professor of gender, sexuality and women's studies at York University in Toronto. Andrea is a prolific writer and researcher on the topic of motherhood and the social construct of what she calls intensive mothering.
How has motherhood changed in the last 20 years? Good question and a hard question. I teach a course at York University, a full-year women's studies course. When I open my course, I often ask my students, what is a good mother today? What is she supposed to look like? What is she supposed to do? What traits is she supposed to have? And I'm quite amazed how much these students are in agreement. And many of them are not mothers. They're young, you know, women, not yet considering motherhood. But they agree. They, even though they're not mothers, they've been already very much affected by the dominant, what I call the dominant discourse or the dominant ideology. And they all say, well, a mother should be, you know, a certain age, right? You can't be too young anymore. So you have to be, in your late 20s to your early 30s. If you're 18, you're too young. If you're 40, you're too old. A mother is supposed to be patient. She's never to anger. Her whole life is to center on her children. They must come first. Mother love is considered timeless, the best. Any care given other than the biological mother is seen as insufficient. And that includes even husbands, that children should be raised by the biological mother 24/7, around the clock. She should be completely attuned to the needs of the child. More recently, which I can talk more about later, in the last 10 or 15 years, the ante's been up that she's supposed to be completely devoted and her life is to center upon the cognitive, behavioral, educational, psychological development of her child. It's just not enough to feed and clothe and hug your baby anymore. You have to raise the super child who will get into Harvard by 12 and, you know, discover the cure by cancer by 13 and read 3 languages by 5.
Well, it was really interesting, the interview with Andrea, because it was totally spontaneous. I saw her in the corridor at the University of Ottawa. I was there for a conference, and so was she. And she was actually selling books. And I had no intention of interviewing her, but she just seemed such a dynamic, lively person selling these books that I asked her whether I could interview her, and she said yes. So I think that motherhood is a really great example or expression of how we are controlled in Western society by capitalism, by globalization, by making us constantly feel insecure. We're never good enough. And the prime case where we're never good enough is as mothers. We never quite make the grade. And that was what I wanted to talk to her about.
When I talk about this to my students, they think this type of motherhood has been around forever. Children need this. They believe fundamentally this excessive child-centered, consumer, materialist-based mothering is necessary for children's well-being. And that's the first struggle because in my work I argue fundamentally this is not good for kids or for mothers. And I really try to get my students to think about motherhood outside of a biological natural paradigm. And I say to them there's nothing natural about motherhood, and they have great resistance to that. The point I simply try to make is the meaning of motherhood, how we are expected to mother, told to mother, is culturally determined. It changes radically throughout history, and the work I do is to try to put motherhood in historical context and to show my students, and in my own writing, how motherhood is constantly reinvented. So what was a good mother in 1950s, today, she would certainly not qualify as a good mother. She'd be considered a bad mother. And yet, in her time, a 1950s mother would be considered a good mother. But the standards of motherhood have changed fundamentally and radically in the last 20, 30, 40 years.
What was the economic event that changed it? You know, you were talking about the post-war right. years and the 50s and the 60s, where it was absolutely much more laid back, to the point where I am too ashamed to discuss my daughter's childhood with her. But then it changed again.
My argument and what I do in my research is I think it changed, began to change in the mid-1980s. We certainly saw the beginning of it earlier, but I really believe the 1970s was probably the best time to be a mother, because not only did you have relaxed motherhood, but now you had feminism too. Right. So what happens in the 80s that causes motherhood and eventually gives rise to what us scholars call intensive mothering, this highly competitive, completely regulatory mothering where if you're not a good mom, you're nothing. Right. The standards have gone through the roof. Your child, as I said, has to speak three languages by five, has to read by one. Hyper, hyper competitive. More generally, the rise of consumerism and materialism more generally in the 80s, where class becomes marked through personal acquisition of wealth, right? Bigger homes, bigger cars, bigger vacations, and children become a status symbol. They become the new accessory that marks your class. And in the 50s, you marked your class by having a stay-at-home wife. You knew you made it to the middle class when you had a stay-at-home wife. Well, that's not possible in the 80s anymore. With the two recessions we had, middle-class families have working wives. So you can't mark your class anymore by having your wife at home. So you marked your class through children. So the smarter child, the child with the best clothes, the best bedroom, the most stuff, becomes a marker of class mobility. And so that's one thing. I really think it's tied in with class. I think another big reason is simply demographics. Women started having fewer children in the 70s and 80s.
We're speaking to Andrea O'Reilly, a professor of gender, sexuality and women's studies at York University in Toronto.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by CFRC. Music this week was by Feist. Headlines this week were written by Gretchen King. And we also thank Gennarji O'Sullivan, Michael Welch, and Audrey O'Brien. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the members of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.